Here's an object. I'll use this eraser, right? Now, am I an object? Do I exist? Does the eraser exist? Okay, so we're both objects. We both exist. But obviously there's something different about my existence than that of the eraser. Not only am I better looking than the eraser. See, that would be the approach of the late 20th century. Emphasize aesthetics, right? No, Hegel said, this eraser is not aware of itself as an object. Isn't that true? But I am aware of myself. And so he says, spirit is in its existence aware of itself as an object. And it's not just aware of itself as an object in a way that an eraser is not aware of itself, but it's aware of itself as an object which reflects its own self. Okay, so it's one thing to reflect upon myself, and it's another thing to reflect upon myself as an object that reflects upon myself. You all with me? That's an even higher level of abstraction. He says, mind, which when thus developed, knows itself to be mind. When you come to know yourself as a reflective object that reflects on itself, that's science. When you advance to the level of mind becoming that precise, that self-reflective, then you reach the level of science. According to Hegel, all reality is mind coming to self-consciousness. 10 minutes ago, you had not even thought about this difference between yourself and the eraser. You were using your minds, but you weren't thinking of yourselves as reflective, and you were not thinking of yourselves as objects which have the ability to do that self-reflection. And so you know what happened in the last 10 minutes? You came to greater self-consciousness, didn't you? Now you know yourselves better. This is no joke. This is serious stuff. And by the way, I don't have any trouble with this. I agree with that. Mind does come to greater self-consciousness. If I can use a more crude example, there was a day when I played tennis and basketball, and I thought that was just great. I even hoped I'd be a professional tennis player once. Just loved doing it. Didn't think much about my heart beating. And then the doctor said, you got a heart problem. And now I started thinking a lot about hearts. And I learned a lot about hearts. And I went through heart surgery and almost died in one of them, and so forth. Now, isn't it true that I've become a lot more self-conscious about heart-related issues? Sure. There was a day when I just went out and played tennis. My heart was beating, but I wasn't real self-conscious. Now I'm real self-conscious about it. So mind develops. As we learn more, we learn more about ourselves. And what he said is all reality. Now, I've just talked about my individual mind. But Hegel said that's true of all reality. All reality is mind coming to greater and greater self-consciousness. And so reality is the outworking of spirit or mind. You have to remember mind and spirit are just different translations of Geist. All reality is mind coming to self-consciousness. I had told you that Hegel studied theology early in his life and wrote essays on Christianity and so forth. And so before I move on to my next point, I want to add that his idealism, where the real is the rational and the rational is the real, has to be related to religious conceptions. And I quote him here, quote, philosophy must end in religion. Philosophy must end in religion. Why did he say that? Well, according to him, reason demands its complement. Reason, in the nature of itself, is it draws distinctions. It objectifies things. You know? But if you draw distinctions, then your reasoning is finite, and it's about finite things, because only finite things can be distinguished. But how can we think about finite things if there isn't the corresponding infinite in terms of which the finite makes sense? Accordingly, Hegel thought that reasoning and philosophy ultimately demanded the complement to the finiteness of our thinking in the ultimate thought of the infinite, which he called religion. So Hegel believed he was a religious philosopher. I'm not real impressed with his religious philosophy. I don't want to say that it's the sort of thing you can take into the church and preach and it makes godly people. But on the other hand, he believed that he was oriented in a religious direction, in that true religion was coming to understand the infinite, and that's what philosophy demanded. In fact, he offered his idealism, this is dreadful, but he offered his idealism as the philosophical interpretation of Christianity. If you wanted to know what Christianity was all about, of course, the Bible was written for people who didn't think highly sophisticated, abstract thoughts like philosophers. But if you want to understand what the Bible's getting at, its inner core, its idealistic philosophy. Hegel's idealism, he said, he viewed as the philosophical interpretation of Christianity. Christianity is but a non-rational manifestation of the absolute, the infinite. So when you read the Bible, when you talk about Christian theology, you're not using the high-level abstract powers of philosophy and reason. It's non-rational. But what it's giving a manifestation of at that low level of expression is the absolute, is the infinite. And in particular, Hegel saw the incarnation, the Christian doctrine of incarnation, as a way of speaking of mind projecting its other. Now, what stands over against mind? Nature. Nature. So you have nature, things, the physical world, and you have mind. And according to Hegel's idealism, mind projects its other, which is nature, and then brings about a synthesis, a resolution of the conflict between mind and nature. And he said that's what the incarnation is. You see, that's God, the absolute, the idea, mind, projecting into nature, the incarnation, the physical being of Jesus, and then overcoming, transcending that opposition. So the incarnation shows that the infinite is manifest in the finite and does not exist wholly apart from the finite. That's the message of the incarnation. Okay, so far, how are you doing with Hegel? You don't have to agree with this. That isn't what philosophy is all about. But can you get, you have some sense of what he's getting at? His view is that reality is ideal. It's mind. It's spirit. And that it's rational. So that the real is found out by studying the reasoning process, and the reasoning process is what is real. Since the real is the rational, according to Hegel, disagreements over the truth can be objectively resolved. People disagree. They see things differently. But all those disagreements must be resolvable, and resolvable objectively. Because if they are not resolvable objectively, then the universe is not rational. And I don't think you should have much trouble with that. The first point is the real is the rational is the real, which is spirit coming to manifestation in the reasoning process. The next point is that reasoning process must overcome conflict, or else it's not reasonable, it's not rational. and I'm going to quote Hegel now. He said, the nature of humanity is to impel men to agree with one another. And its very existence lies simply in the explicit realization of a community of conscious life. The emphasis here is on community. A community of conscious life. What is anti-human, the condition of mere animals, consists in keeping within the sphere of feeling pure and simple. The thing I like about this quote is, boy, it sets Schopenhauer and the Romantics, Romanticist, over against Hegel in a real clear way. Hegel said, you know what's anti-human? Is when you don't want to use reasoning, but you just want to engage in feeling, pure and simple. Men disagree with one another, and their disagreements must be rationally and objectively resolvable. That's the nature of humanity, to impel men to agree with one another. Okay. If that's our starting point, the rationality of the universe, and this leads us to the corollary that all disagreements must be surmountable, must be objectively resolvable, then the next point in explaining Hegel is that every particular assertion made by somebody can only be a partial truth. Every assertion, every particular claim made by somebody is a partial truth. We want to put equal emphasis on the word partial and truth. Every assertion is a truth of some sort. People are reflecting something in their experience which is true whenever they say something. Do you agree with that? If you're sympathetic to Hegel, you should be able to agree with that. Let's take the most outlandish counterexample. The easy counterexamples are things that are said that are imprecise, that we wouldn't call true, but there's something to them. If you have a little child, and I've raised children, and I've been a child, I know what this is like. A child runs out of his bedroom at night and says that he's seen a ghost or somebody's at his window. Now, that's not precisely true. At least we don't usually think it is. But on the other hand, we don't think that our children are just openly lying. They can learn to do that after they've had the original experience. But the first time around, or many times around, children have awakened, and as you know, they are not focusing properly. Something in their room scares them, and they take it to be a ghost, or somebody's in their room, or at their window, and so forth. So that kind of thing is easy to say. There's a partial truth there. You have perceived something, but of course it's not what you're making it out to be and all that. The hard one is, what about a lie? What about somebody who purposely lies? What if I say, you know, I had filet mignon for dinner last night. You were at dinner with me and you know very well that I had salmon for dinner last night. So how is there any partial truth in I had filet mignon? You have to kind of let go of our way of seeing things. As Christians, we don't, you know, sit very loose to this sort of thing. But you know, there's at least this much truth in my lie. I must have wanted filet mignon, or I want you to believe I was somebody who had filet mignon. That tells you something about me. Now again, if you let the ethical dimension go for a second, I gave you an example where you allowed the little child to say, there's a ghost in my room. We don't get all upset about that. We say, well, there's some truth to that. It's not what the child makes it out to be. Now, if you can accept that there's a partial truth in the child's room, why can't you accept there's even a partial truth in a lie? It tells you something about the liar, doesn't it? His way of seeing things or what he wants you to do and so forth. And so I think we can tolerate this, that Hegel is right, that every assertion is a partial truth of some sort. Even lies are some kind of partial truth. But now let's look at even our best assertions, ones that are not like a child confusing, you know, unfocused eyes with ghost in his room, or liars. Let's take the best that science has to offer us. And so, from a scientific standpoint, I can assert that that wall is white. Is that true? It's true as far as it goes. Is it precisely true? No. You know why? Because there are a lot of different shades of white. If I were going to be more truthful than that, I should have said that's eggshell white. I'm not sure if it is, but you know that there's a difference between eggshell white and, I don't know, all the different things. You go into a hardware store and look at the color swatches, and you'll be amazed at all the different shades. And here, I'm accustomed to thinking in terms of white and blue and green, and I can even get, you know, a little sophisticated and have turquoise, you know, and that sort of thing. But there's all these different shades. And so when I said that wall is white, that was true, but it was only partially true, because I could have said it is, I think, eggshell white. And of course, even that probably could be made more precise. But not only that, when I said that wall is white, you know, I didn't tell you what it was made of, did I? There's still only a partial truth about the wall. And so Hegel is telling us that every assertion is a partial truth. Every assertion has some truth in it, but even the truth that's in it is only partial. And so that means that every statement is made from a limited perspective and is characterized by a one-sidedness. A one-sidedness. When I say the wall is white, I'm emphasizing, you know, a certain conception of white, and I'm not telling you everything about the wall or even the various degrees of whiteness. So that for every statement that is made, you can generate a competing assertion that compensates for its one-sidedness. For every statement that is made, you can generate a competing assertion that compensates for its one-sidedness. Now, what I'm telling you is true of every assertion, so don't be misled by the illustration, because I'm trying to make Hegel easy for you. So I'm going to take an easy illustration, and all of you will identify with this. If I were to say, Clinton did a good job in avoiding military confrontation in Haiti, because I know most of you and your socio-political convictions, which are mine as well, you might be inclined, if I said that over lunch, to say, but Dr. Bahnsen, Clinton never should have had us involved in Haiti in the first place. Or, but Dr. Bahnsen, didn't you know that he avoided military service himself, and so he's something of a hypocrite. Or, but Dr. Bahnsen, don't you realize this man's immoral and he's a liar? Now, let's just take the immorality and alleged deception of which our president is guilty. That's a truth about him, allegedly. That's a truth about him. But it's also true that what he did in Haiti, at least at this point on the day of this lecture, has avoided military confrontation. So I told you a partial truth. But in saying it to you, it also generated a compensating truth. Because you want to be more objective and balanced, your inclination is to say, all right, he may have gotten by this time, but he's still a liar. Now, I'm playing on your prejudices here because they'll help you to understand Hegel. Hegel says every assertion that is made has the same kind of thing that happens. It generates its compensating, balancing statement. So for every thesis, there's an antithesis that is given to help counterbalance that. Okay, Beth? What is the common truth? Oh, yes. Well, Hegel, I appreciate that you're turning Hegel on himself, and I'm going to do that eventually as well. But I'm afraid that that may confuse some members of the class. You understand the nature of the question? If every assertion must have its compensating one-sided assertion, then let's take the assertion that every statement requires its counterbalancing statement. Hegel would say, in this case he has an answer for you, Hegel would say, you have to remember that when I tell you that every assertion is a partial truth, I'm speaking from a limited perspective, from the perspective of, well, now, 1994 for Hegel, the 1800s, and that what you have every right to compensate against the statement is that the day is coming where the truth will be complete and absolute. To which the compensating statement is, but we're not there now. Okay, so it won't be too long until you can, I think, savage Hegel. But if you just give him a little room, so far we don't have to complain about this. Even this statement, given his philosophy, has its counterbalancing statement about the universality of the truth that is coming. There was another hand, I think. Mike. Well, as I told you, according to Hegel, the Bible is a low-level, non-rational manifestation of idealistic philosophy. So he would say what the Bible is saying, when properly interpreted, is in agreement with what he's asserting here. The very fact that the Bible has to be explained shows that it's only partial truth. And on this, he's right. The Bible doesn't come in digested form, does it? Okay, so Hegel would say, even given your, I mean, maybe he'd make fun of it as fundamentalistic prejudices. Even from your fundamentalistic presentation, you know that the truth is not there just in the Bible. You have to have the Bible, and then the Spirit helps you interpret the Bible and internalize it. And he'd say, by the way, what we're talking about here is just a manifestation of what I'm trying to tell you. Every truth has its compensating truth, and you need synthesis, so you bring these two together. Why do men disagree with each other? Because they have emphasized aspects of the truth differently. All partial perspectives can be harmonized in a more inclusive outlook. Now, Beth Bogue is going to say, what's the compensating truth for that one? All partial perspectives can be harmonized in a more inclusive outlook? Well, I guess the compensating truth is they have not been harmonized in a more inclusive outlook. And so what I said here is still only partial. The more inclusive statement, let's forget the big broad area that Beth has introduced for us here. How does Hegel fit in? By the way, I appreciate this because she's really down the line. In the end, I'm going to say, what's Hegel make of his own philosophy? And he's on the horns of the dilemma, isn't he? Either his own philosophy is the absolute mind, finally come to full expression, and so it doesn't have to be qualified, in which case he is extremely arrogant, or his own philosophy would require him to say that even his own philosophy cannot be ultimate. Okay? So Beth is on to a good point. It's just the internal working out of this allows him the ability to play with this. If you forget the big questions about his whole system, just take partial statements like, the window is open. Well, in some cases, people might be inclined to say the window is not open. It all depends on how open is. You know, like the window example, how about bald? Walking through an airport, you say, boy, that poor guy, he's bald. Somebody says, no, he's still got a little bit of hair. He's not bald. One-sided understandings of baldness or openness and so forth. the more inclusive statement, once we resolve the thesis-antithesis, will itself prove to be a partial statement in need of its own correction. And thus the more inclusive statement generates its own compensating alternatives as well, and on and on and on it goes. So I think I can diagram this for you. What we're trying to understand is reasoning, because after all, the universe is rational. All disagreements should be surmountable then, objectively. Well, disagreements take the form of a thesis, which is compensated for by an antithesis. And what Hegel says is a more inclusive statement, which would be more precise and also more universal at the same time, right? More universal because it covers more, and more precise because it gets away from what is false in both sides. The more universal and precise statement will be a synthesis. But this synthesis, in a sense, is another thesis, isn't it? And so it will call for its counterbalancing antithesis. And once we look at this, the more inclusive statement that is more universal but also more precise, that brings together this synthesis and antithesis, is another synthesis. I'll call it synthesis two here. But synthesis two is going to be partial and one-sided and call for its compensating antithesis. But since the world is rational, then synthesis two with its antithesis, I guess I should have started numbering the antitheses, right? This one would be two, this one would be three. We'll call for another. Now, do I have to keep this up, or have you got the point? The universe, the rationality of the universe requires the reasoning process to be dialectical, so that all partial and conflicting perspectives are worked out through this process of thesis, compensation, and synthesis. I'm going to stop to see if you have any questions at this point. Yes, sir?
So, in Hegel, are there any absolutes at all before the absolute truth?
No. In fact, what you've just said, he would say, stop and think about what you've just said. There can't be absolutes before the absolute. So the whole point is we're moving toward the rational absolute mind. And until we get there, everything's in the process of working out these partial perspectives. Well?
Is there, like, in his philosophy of consummation, I mean, like I know that he talks about spiraling up and stuff, thesis and all that, is there, like, a timetable that he sees as far as the consummation?
Well, not a timetable in the sense that some people try to prophesy when Jesus will return. They have a timetable for that. But Hegel did project eschatologically the day when, in fact, we're going to start talking about this now, when nature and mind would become one. Now, this gets a little tougher. So far, I think, even if you disagree with this, you can understand it. We're going to have to look at something that's a little bit harder for us, but not impossible. Just be sympathetic, be abstract, and follow this.
Speaking of his absolute truth in the spiral, this goes back to the more monistic idea of reality.
Yes, in the end, when we reflect on Hegel, we have to say he obviously was a monist. He didn't see the universe as discrete entities. All those discrete entities are, in one sense, related to each other. There's an interrelation, and ultimately, all will be one. Okay, the next point in our understanding of Hegel is the view that minds and their objects are functionally related to each other.
minds and their objects are not independent of each other, but functionally related. When I say that minds and their objects are not independent, I am directly assaulting your naive common sense view of the world. Now, I'm not saying that so that you'll feel insulted, but you need to know that what you take for granted, Hegel is here saying, no, that's very naive and imprecise. You shouldn't see it that way. Because we tend to think, what are some of the objects for my mind? Here's one object for my mind. Detroit beat Dallas in football last night. That's something I can think about. Right? Here's another object for my mind. This textbook. Right? You are objects for my mind. Okay? So we've already talked about the difference between the subject and the object of knowledge. We tend to think, well, those things are totally independent. One way we see their independence is that, let's say that I didn't have this book as an object for my mind. Would my mind still be my mind? What if Detroit had not beat Dallas in football last night? Would my mind still be my mind? Well, we all tend to say, well, of course. My mind is my mind. It's all a question of what the furniture is. One piece of mental furniture is Detroit beating Dallas. Another piece is this textbook. Another piece is other things that you know. But some of you see it. That's very naive, isn't it? Because when I talk about my mind, when I started this illustration a few moments ago, and I referred to my mind, the mind I was referring to is one that's already been informed of that football game last night. And my mind is different for knowing that than if I didn't know that. And so if we were to go back and say there was no football game or Detroit didn't win the football game, it isn't as though you just pull that out there and I still have my mind. Is this something like Heraclitus? You can't step in the same river twice? Yeah, it's kind of like that. Not altogether. What Hegel's trying to get us to realize is that our minds are our minds because of their objects. Some of you, I hope, well, I don't know if I hope. I would imagine some of you did not know that Detroit beat Dallas last night in this football game. So if we came in here, if we could just freeze frame all of our minds when we walked in here this morning, there would certainly be a difference between your mind and my mind. Because my mind knew this one thing that your mind didn't know. In fact, you could put all of your experiences together. Some are similar to mine, but many are unique from mine. Your mind is your mind, not my mind. I know sometimes we tend to think, isn't this getting a little silly? No, it's very profound. You see, a mind is not a mind all by itself, like an empty tank over here, and then you start dumping the furniture of knowledge into it. And so Hegel said the mind and its objects are reciprocally related. My mind has its particular character somewhat because of its objects. And we already know that the objects of the mind are what? They're affected by the mind itself. Where did we learn that? Class? Who taught us that the mind? Kant, exactly. And so Kant shows us that the mind is active, forming its objects. Hegel realizes that the mind itself is affected by its objects. That's what makes it my mind, and so forth. And so these two are functionally related to each other. Now Hegel said, and this is another quotation, short enough for you to get it down, everything depends on grasping and expressing the ultimate truth, not as substance, but as subject as well. Let me say it again. Everything depends on grasping and expressing the ultimate truth, not as substance, but as subject as well. You didn't have the advantage of Dr. Bonson making this somewhat cheerful and understandable. You might read a sentence like that and say, hey, let's go play football. What is this crucial thing? Everything depends on grasping this, that the ultimate truth is expressed not as substance, but as subject as well. Well, let's take the word substance to refer to objects, those things that exist. And the point is that you have not expressed the ultimate truth until it is expressed as a subject, not just an object or a substance. The ultimate truth of reality must be subjectively expressed. How would you like it if we said, you know, the ultimate truth is this erasure? You say, no, that won't quite do. I mean, totally apart from all the other things you might want to incorporate. You say, because certainly there's something more true than just this is an eraser. It would be far more true if the eraser were expressing what it is to be an eraser. Can I adequately explain your life if I just describe all the substance truths about you? What if I were to say, well, here's a person who's 5'10", weighs 190, you know, spent much of his or her life in this region of the world, on and on and on. Now, those things all may be very true, but they couldn't be the ultimate truth about you because they don't express what? Which is most unique about you, and that's you're a subject. What does it feel like to be 5'10", I forget what my illustration was, 180, and to live in this part of the world all your life? The subject expressing that is far more true than just any substance remark made about that subject. And so Hegel says everything depends on grasping and expressing the ultimate truth, not as substance, as dead object, if you will, but as subject as well. Previous philosophers had approached the world as a realm of objects or substances which have independent existence and that are unchanging, if you will. They endure as substances out there. And what happens is their attributes change. Okay, so we have an apple tree out here, and the attributes of the apple tree may change. It has more or less leaves, more or less apples, this or that color. But the apple tree-ness is unchanging. For Hegel, there is no such thing in itself, the apple tree-ness of which the color, the branches, the fruit are all attributes. There is no Kantian thing in itself, or, if you will, if you've had my class before, no Lockean substance lying behind the attributes. Hegel took consciousness, not substance, to be the primary metaphysical concept. Let me say that again. Hegel took consciousness, not substance, to be the primary metaphysical concept. Past philosophers had thought in terms of things which have attributes, and then these things are lying underneath their attributes. They're the substance of the attributes. Kant got to the place where he spoke of the thing in itself rather than the thing as it appears. Hegel says, let's get rid of substance altogether and think rather in terms of consciousness as the primary concept for everything that exists. When I'm aware of myself, I'm not simply aware of an object that's other than me. Awareness of self is not awareness of an object other than me. I hate to take the plunge here. Please stick with me. Persevere. Awareness of self is simply awareness of objects as other than me. As far as we know, the eraser is not aware of anything other than itself. It's an object for it, excuse me, in itself. That's it. But I'm an object for itself because I am aware of objects as being other than me. And thus my mind is not simply an object. And yet, as we've already said, my mind cannot be independent of objects. If my mind were completely independent of objects, it wouldn't be a mind, would it? It'd be an empty shell. What's that empty shell? Well, even calling it a shell is to make something of it. And so isn't this strange? The mind is not independent of its objects, and yet the mind is not an object. And so what am I? What is my mind? Hegel said the mind is developmental. Crucial point. The mind is developmental. I'm adding that observation to what we already have on the board, that minds and their objects are functionally related. Even before we get there, can you see where we're going? If minds and their objects are functionally related and the mind is developmental, then the objects of the mind must be developmental too. The self-identity of the conscious mind is obviously not made up of its varying objects. Okay, what am I thinking about right now? A classroom sitting in front of me. What am I thinking about right now? A football game last night. What am I thinking about right now? What will I have for lunch? As I go through these various objects, is it still my mind that's going through these objects? Yes. Well, what is the self-identity of the conscious mind? It can't be the objects because they vary. It's rather a matter of degree. A matter of degree. As one absorbs more objects. As one absorbs more objects. You know what the developmental idea of the mind is. Infants have a mind, a mindset, and it develops. Adults have a more sophisticated mind than an infant. But even among adults, there are more sophisticated minds, right? Those who have studied more, thought more, been more reflective over against those who just drink beer and watch football. So the mind develops by degrees. And that development is a matter of absorbing more objects. So the one who understands himself better is the one who has experienced things as other than me yet related to me. The more advanced mindset or consciousness is the one that experiences things as other than me yet related to me. Go back to the point that you understood a minute ago. Minds and their objects are functionally related. Well, you know what? You didn't think about this, most of you, probably all of you, didn't think about that until you came into this class this morning. But now that you understand that, your minds have become more self-conscious. Now you understand yourself better, and you understand the world better, too. And so, the more highly developed self-conscious mind understands that he is someone that experiences things as other than me, yet related to me. You've come to a higher level of consciousness when you see that all things are different, and yet still related to you. There's identity, and yet there's difference in everything that I think about. Where Kant had a static concept of the mind as related to its objects, Hegel had a developmental view of the mind. So for Kant, the mind could be likened to a judge at a trial. The judge is in court, and the judge stays apart from what he's judging, right? He should. If he's a good judge, he's objective, he's indifferent, he is, if you will, at a distance from the parties and from the accusation and from the evidence and the facts and all that. He rather stands above it, sits above it. We actually, you know, paint that picture for ourselves. The judge sits above what's being tried as to the facts and the guilt down here. So that's Kant's view of the mind. The mind is like a judge. It's sitting back here and judging the objects out there. Whereas for Hegel, Hegel viewed the mind not as a courtroom judge, but as a bud that develops into a blossom, which develops into the full fruit. The bud, the blossom, and the full fruit are not disinterested and contemplative like a judge. There's rather an inner force shaping the way objects are seen and shaping the way culture is developed. As the mind develops, it's not sitting out here apart from its objects, judging them and coming to greater and greater truth. Rather, the mind is entering into the objects, as part of the objects. Because they're related to the mind, the world is changing as your mind is changing. And so, rather than having these distinct things, minds over here, objects over here, the smart minds have more objects in them, Hegel saw it rather that all minds are developing like a bud develops into a blossom, develops into the fruit. They're related organically and internally. And so the development of the mind from childhood through adulthood, bud, blossom to fruit, according to Hegel, parallels a development of the corporate mind from the earliest times to the present. This is another step. The parallel between the individual and the corporate. There's a parallel development between the individual and what I am calling the corporate mind, because I think that will get the point across to you better. Hegel spoke of the Zeitgeist, you German experts, Zeitgeist, spirit of the age, right? The time mind, the time spirit, or the spirit of that time. And according to Hegel, every age and culture has its mindset, its outlook, its perspective, its zeitgeist. And there's a development of zeitgeist in cultures. And he claimed, that development of the corporate mind, the zeitgeist, parallels the development of the individual mind from childhood through adulthood. We've already learned from Hegel that all contradictions are only apparent and arise from partial viewpoints. Likewise, he would say, the different mindsets throughout history seem to be conflicting with each other, but they're simply developmental stages through which consciousness is passing. There is a universal consciousness that is developing through the mindsets, the zeitgeist, of the different cultures and ages. And each successively higher level of consciousness incorporates what was true in the preceding partial and conflicting perspectives. Remember, thesis, antithesis, and then the more universal and yet more detailed and precise synthesis. And so every age sees that kind of development as well. Question? Yes. Yeah, and we call it universal consciousness, but you see at this point it's not truly universal. because when it becomes universal, it'll be complete and there'll be no more development. But this corporate, broader zeitgeist, or if you will, the spirit develops through the various cultures or mindsets in history, with thesis, antithesis, synthesis, then another antithesis and another synthesis. And so the corporate mind is developing, even as our individual minds develop, as we learn more and overcome more contradictions and more negations. Yes. Well, if it did, I don't recall Hegel talking about that, but if it did, it would have to not be moving in the direction of universality, but to non-existence. No, what you would have is that as the synthesis incorporates more universally the particulars, what is false becomes less universal, and therefore it's moving toward zero, toward nothingness. No, he doesn't have a view of the great chain of being, because he doesn't want being to be the elementary metaphysical notion. Not substance, but consciousness. Consciousness is developing. Well, the next point I want to put on the board here is the need for concrete universals. The need for concrete universals. Hegel's outlook was that traditional rationalism oversimplifies things, because it doesn't pay attention to the rich nuances that distinguish and make individual members of a class individuals. Okay, let's think of a class here. How about the class of humanity, the set of all human beings? Is it accurate to speak of the set of all human beings? Is there a set of all human beings? Be careful. Yes and no. Yes, because there are things that fall into that class. But Hegel would say, isn't that terribly oversimple? Because once you put everybody in this class of human beings, you're assuming you don't have one human beingness here. You have individuals that are in this class. Well, how can they be individuals if they're all in the same class? That is, we have to take account of the fact that some human beings are female, some are male. Some are pug-nosed, some have Roman noses. Some are blonde, some are brunette. Some are tall, some are small. And on and on and on. And so, when you have your rational categories, that may all seem well and good to you, but the individuals that are put into those categories are having their individuality suppressed. So they're not completely adequate. He said they're overly simple. They're not paying attention to all the variety. And therefore, universal categories tend to suppress the individuality of the members of those categories. The universals are too abstract, if you will. Remember, a few minutes ago, I said I go into the paint store and I see all this plethora of, you know, various degrees of colors and so forth. And here I tended to think in terms of blue and red and green and white. Obviously, my paint categories or my color categories were too broad, weren't they? They were oversimple. In the same way, Hegel said all rational categories tend to be that way. Now, the tendency would be for people who are more the romantic mindset, remember, forget rationality, just get in touch with reality. Have a direct intuition, experience, a savoring of the world as it really is. That is, have immediate feeling. Well, when you have immediate feeling of things, you have more individuality, right? You don't experience the hot fudge sundae that you're eating as hot fudge sundiness. No, it's this particular hot fudge sundae that this particular spoon is scooping out and putting in this particular mouth, having this particular sensation. Right? The feeling approach is very particular and doesn't worry about general categories. Well, the problem with that is the naive approach to reality overlooks the mediated character of our experience. After all, I may not be thinking about it being a hot fudge sundae and chocolate having the following chemical breakdown and so forth when I'm scooping it into my mouth and just having a direct, you know, feeling of that. But it's certainly true that I want to think of that and it to be a hot fudge sundae rather than something that's poisonous or something that I don't enjoy eating. I don't like mushrooms or squid. And so, obviously, as I'm even in my naive experience enjoying the hot fudge sundae, I'm enjoying it as a hot fudge sundae, not as squid with mushrooms. And so the direct approach, the feely individuality approach, overlooks the mediated character of our experience. That we don't just naively experience the world, we have to think about the world, and when you think about the world, you need concepts. And so, doggone it, here the people who use concepts are overly simple, too abstract, and here the people who don't use concepts can't get away from using concepts, they're too direct. How do you get scientific? Well, what would Hegel say from all that I told you? Don't you have to take the thesis and the antithesis and bring them together? The scientific consciousness is going to be conceptual. It mediates experience through our thinking. It's not just going to use inarticulate feeling, but the concepts used in science, by the way, science here doesn't mean natural science, it means organized intellect. The scientific consciousness will be conceptual, but its concepts will be concrete, not abstract, broad, preconceived ideas imposed on our experience. And because they are concrete, they will be adequate to the diversity of the experiences we have. And that's what Hegel called a concrete universal. Just to help you in your reading, the translators take Begriff in German, and they used to call that a notion, the concrete universal. Today it's more likely translated concept. But science deals with notions or concepts which are not the rational, a priori, over general, over simple things, but they aren't just direct intuition and the feeling of the world either. They're concrete universals. Not a concept imposed from outside, but rather a concept that develops within the content of thought and reflects the uniqueness of thought. It includes the feeling of being what the concept is about. Okay? You have substance out here, which is not subject, it's just in itself. Then you have the subject over here that's for itself. And when the subject has an adequate scientific concept, he has somehow synthesized the for itself and the in itself, so that the concept is also, the adequate concept you have, because it's concrete, involves a feeling of what the concept is about, as well as being the concept. Now, the best part of the system is, we need universal, unqualified truth. This is the aspect of Hegel that you might call a monism of absolute spirit. Given the above assumptions, and because our tape's about ready to end, let me just say, you should go back, before we continue this lecture tomorrow, go back and just look at the steps along the way. I realize it isn't all, you know, perfectly clear, but just try to understand the partial insights that he has and what he's trying to achieve. They're going to lead to the idea that truth cannot be the truth at a particular time. All truth is historical and developmental, and it must be developing toward an absolute, universal, and unqualified truth. And when that happens, when you have the unqualified universal truth, it won't just be a truth that's known out there by a mind, it'll be the mind that knows it. And so all of thought and nature